Hello and welcome to Bullshare. This podcast is a production of UB Law Responds from the University of Buffalo School of Law's Clinical Legal Education Program. My name is Kim Diana Connolly. I have the honor of serving as the director of UB's clinical program. Today, we conclude our four-part series on domestic violence and intimate partner violence within the context of COVID-19. This important series has been organized and is hosted by student attorneys from our COVID Law and Community Engagement Clinic, Peter Perugia and Lindsay Lowen. On today's episode, student attorneys Peter and Lindsay host two amazing women, Judy Torres and Aldiyama Anthony. Ms. Torres is the Director of Domestic Violence Services at Hispanics United of Buffalo, as well as a retired dispatcher with the Buffalo Police Department. Ms. Anthony is a current pro bono scholar at the University of Buffalo School of Law, and a former student attorney with the Family Violence and Women's Rights Clinic. She's also the 2020-2021 president of the Black Law Students Association at the University of Buffalo School of Law. We're excited you tuned in today for this episode and hope you enjoy.
All right, everybody. So this is Peter Ferrugia and Lindsay Logan, three L's and student attorneys at the University at Buffalo School of Law. Peter, me, is currently enrolled as a student at the University of Buffalo School of Law as a JD MBA Health Law and Policy and Healthcare Management candidate. Lindsay is currently enrolled as a student at the University of Buffalo School of Law as a JD with a focus in family and matrimonial law. Both Peter and Lindsay presently serve clients in the newly created UB Law Responds COVID Response Legal Clinic. Today, we welcome our listeners to today's Bullshare podcast hosted by the UB Law Responds UB Law School Clinics. This podcast is the fourth and final episode of a four-part series, all of which have discussed the topic of domestic violence, or DV, and intimate partner violence, or IPV, in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic. Our goal has been to explore various ways in which survivors of IPV and DV have been impacted by the pandemic and how their safety has been increasingly compromised as a result of the social distancing measures implemented as a result of the pandemic. Today, we have two very special guests joining us. We will be speaking with Aldiyama Anthony, who is an international student from the Commonwealth of Dominica, also a 3L at the University of Buffalo School of Law. Her interest in law began during her undergraduate studies at Monroe College, where she completed her Bachelor of Science degree in criminal justice, graduating with honors summa cum laude. Ms. Anthony then pursued her paralegal certification at Pace University, where she graduated as valedictorian of her class. Currently, Ms. Anthony is the 2020-2021 president of the Black Law Students Association here at UB Law, the upstate sub-regional director of the Northeast Black Law Students Association. The honorary law student for the Women's Bar Association of the State of New York, Western New York Chapter, and a 2021 pro bono scholar. Additionally, Ms. Anthony is in her second and final semester of the Family Violence and Women's Rights Clinic, where she actively seeks to fill the gap to ensure survivors of IPV receive the proper legal representation and advocacy needed in many areas of the law, including family offense petitions, child support, custody, and visitation cases.
We also welcome Judy Torres, Director of Domestic Violence Services at Hispanics United of Buffalo, commonly known as HUB. Prior to working with HUB, Judy worked with the Buffalo Police Department in dispatching for 36 years and only retired as recently as 2016. After only 4 months of retirement, Judy began working with Hispanics United of Buffalo in May 2017. Hispanics United of Buffalo has the only bilingual domestic violence program in Erie County. Ms. Torres assists HUB in its mission to empower survivors of domestic violence to move forward in a life free of violence by providing education and raising community awareness of the harmful effects of domestic violence. Ms. Torres and her colleagues provide comprehensive support services to survivors of IPV, to include safety planning, advocacy services, case management, referrals to shelters and housing alternatives, non-clinical counseling, and assistance navigating the court system as well. HUB also provides parenting classes and a 12-week support group recognized by the Erie County Department of Social Services, the courts, and other service providers. By way of an introduction to the context of today's conversation, and before we proceed, we'd like to clarify the term domestic violence comes from a traditional view of violence in a relationship. as focused on abuse between two people in a heterosexual marriage. Typically, the husband was the abuser and the wife was the victim. However, we now know that abuse within relationships expands far beyond these limited borders, and society has worked in recent years to better understand the violence that exists within modern relationships and to educate society that roles of abuser and victim are not gender specific. Around the year 2000, the term intimate partner violence was introduced to provide for a more comprehensive understanding of violence in relationships. This has helped to move the general societal view away from abusive violence existing only within the confines of heterosexual marriage and expands it in a way that acknowledges abuse can exist in any type of personal intimate relationship, regardless of sexual orientation, marital status, or gender identity. Throughout this conversation, you will hear us use the abbreviation IPV versus DV. IPV includes physical violence, emotional abuse, sexual violence, victim isolation, economic abuse, stalking, and intimidation, and it can happen to anyone. As of 2010, on average, nearly 20 people per minute were physically abused by an intimate partner in the U.S., 10 million people per year. As of the same year, there were more than 20,000 phone calls placed to IPV hotlines nationwide. These pre-pandemic statistics do not reflect the isolation and distancing necessitated by COVID-19, which, as one can imagine, has had a detrimental, if not deadly, impact on survivors of IPV. Around the world, everyone has been forced to grapple with the new pandemic reality, as countries have adopted measures meant to slow the spread of COVID-19, to include isolation mandates, quarantine, travel restrictions, social distancing, and other mitigation efforts. Schools have closed, employees often work remotely, and businesses often remain open for only essential reasons. Families and domestic partners literally cannot escape one another. Being in close quarters for such extreme amounts of time has proven socially, financially, and psychologically stressful for most, and the results of the stress have seeped into domestic and interpersonal relationships, creating a second pandemic, if you will, of increasingly frequent, severe, and dangerous family violence in the home, as noted by the New York Times in April of 2020.
For women of color in particular, systemic and institutionalized racism has led to high rates of poverty, lower educational attainment, limited job resources, language barriers, and for undocumented women, fear of deportation, which have all increased difficulty in finding help and support services. Women of color are not a monolith. Each community in particular has their own unique circumstances and context. However, there are common factors that may account for underreporting of instances of IPV. These often include religious beliefs that reinforce the woman's victimization and legitimizes the abuser's behavior, fear of isolation and alienation, a strong loyalty to both immediate and extended family, as well as loyalty to race and culture, colloquially called the yoke of silence, guarded trust and reluctance to discuss private matters, fear of rejection from family, friends, congregation, and community, a severe distrust of law enforcement for fear of subjecting themselves and loved ones to a criminal and civil justice system they see as sexist and/or racially and culturally biased, and a skepticism of distrust that shelter and intervention services are not culturally or linguistically competent. For Black women, an estimated 30% are survivors of IPV in their lifetime, and Black women experience IPV at a rate 35% higher than their white counterparts and 2.5 times higher than other races. Additionally, they are much more likely to be victims of IPV homicide as well, according to the National Violence Against Women Survey. As a result of historical present-day racism, African-American women may be less likely to report abusers or seek help because of discrimination, Black men's vulnerability to police brutality, and negative stereotyping. Non-arrests of suspected abusers of Black women and a fear that police will exercise an abusive power have contributed to African-American women's reluctance to involve law enforcement. Stereotypes amplify the complexities Black women encounter when trying to seek help services. Myths that Black women are domineering figures that require control or that Black women are exceptionally strong under stress and are resilient increase their vulnerability and discourage some from speaking out about abuse. For Latinx women, it is estimated that 25% are survivors of IPV in their lifetimes. And for those Latinx women who are immigrants, 48% report increased instances of IPV post-immigration to the U.S. Additionally, 16% of Latinx youth report greater instances of IPV than their white counterparts. Culture has a profound and significant influence on the decisions and actions Latinx survivors have to consider. In Latinx culture, women are often designated to the roles of wife and mother. It is socially unacceptable to be divorced, to marry several times, or to remain single and have children out of wedlock. For these reasons, it may take some time for battered women to consider leaving their partners. Additionally, machismo culture refers to excessive and toxic masculinity, and most machistas believe in conservative gender role ideas, for example, opposing a woman's right to work, participating in sports, or pursuing other traditionally male roles in society. The female equivalent is Marianismo, a term derived from Catholic beliefs of the Virgin Mary as both a virgin and a Madonna, as well as the personification of the ideal woman. Inaccessibility to information and resources in the victim's native language prevent many Latinx survivors from seeking the appropriate services to aid them. In Mexico, a law called Abandono de Hogar punishes women who leave their homes even to flee violence. Women convicted of abandoning the home often lost custody of their children. Some Mexican women who immigrate to the U.S. erroneously believe that this law applies here. Studies also show that Latinx women are more concentrated in low-paying, semi-skilled occupations than the overall workforce. Therefore, limited financial resources create substantial barriers for survivors trying to leave the abuse or trying to obtain legal assistance, housing, and childcare.
Now, as our audience digests all of that information, it's time that we turn the conversation over to our very special guests. First, thank you so much for joining us, Ms. Anthony and Ms. Torres. It's wonderful to have the opportunity to speak with both of you. So if I may begin by asking, in the context of the above statistics that Peter just went through, Ms. Anthony and Ms. Torres, what has your understanding been, given your roles in both the Family Violence and Women's Rights Clinic at UB Law and at Hispanics United of Buffalo, respectively, and as women of color, of the relationship between reporting IPV or witnessing others' willingness to do so? And in your opinion, how do you think the pandemic is specifically affecting BIWOC? It's actually Black women, Indigenous women, and women of color, the abbreviation for which is BIWOC, and Latinx women.
Thank you for this opportunity, and I'm honored to be here and welcome all of you into my space also. The pandemic in and of itself, as we know, caused abusers to be housed with their victims. And it's gotten to be more widespread, obviously. I just read something where it's being referred as the shadow pandemic, the fact that this domestic violence and IPV has gone up so high. So when you house those victims with, especially with the Latina women, it's just echoing what Peter did say, there is this cultural thing where you just don't call the police. Now, the other thing is the problem where what we're having now, the pandemic has caused the response from our police department to go out there, but the arrests are not being made, obviously, because of the fear of COVID. Some reports are being made, some reports are not being made. So that fear of, if I call, nothing really is going to become of this, and it could escalate an already bad situation. In other words, you have the situation, the victim calls the police looking for help, and then nothing really is done about it because of the circumstances of this pandemic, and the situation becomes aggravated. In other words, our clients are put at a much higher risk of being, you know, injured, maimed, even the homicide rate. So the pandemic has caused us to really shelter in place in more ways than one, especially when it's with an abuser. It's very difficult. It really, really is. And it makes our jobs much, much harder trying to reach the women and letting them know that there is help. So the pandemic has caused a shadow pandemic.
Thank you, Ms. Torres, for starting that off, because I guess I would just echo a lot of the things that you said. Based on my understanding and my experience as a woman of color, and also the role that I play in the clinic, I think it's safe to say that reporting IPV is one of the most challenging, if not difficult, tasks that any survivor will have to go through. A survivor's reluctance I tend to see in reporting IPV is a result of several reasons, but those include helplessness, fear, shame. While I've also come across a lot of situations where these women do not believe that they are victims. They are used to so much oppression, so much abuse throughout their lifetime that this new form of abuse in the terms of intimate partner violence is nothing new. And that's just the sad reality of it. I personally think that the pandemic has without a doubt negatively impacted all victims of IPV. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to IPV for our Black, Latin, Indigenous, and women of color, they face a far more unique type of challenge because you tend to see how the economic and the financial impact of the pandemic in itself and how it relates closely to their types of community ties into IPV, because these groups have always been less fortunate when it comes to having easy access to the type of help and resources that they need as victims. And now with further isolation, just echoing Ms. Torres, it's much more harder for them to get out of these situations, locate these useful resources, and get the help that they need. So I definitely think that life in itself with the pandemic has just caused a shift and an increase now when it comes to IPV.
Thank you. And Alziama as well, I know you were just touching upon this a bit, but I know you're speaking to some of the fear and the shame that prevent, Black survivors of IPV from reaching out. So I'm wondering not only if you could maybe share a bit more specifically on the fear and trepidation that many Black survivors of IPV have about reaching out to law enforcement, even in light of recent very highly publicized, police brutality fears. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if you could speak to that. And then I'm also wondering what you were just saying led me to be a little bit curious about, even if these survivors gain enough courage or support or whatever the word may be, resolve to report, right? Do you believe that there's enough support or enough resources out there, especially during the pandemic, for them to be able to sustain their ability to maintain safety and independence?
Okay, so I remember reading sometime last year an amazing article by ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, about how the legal system has failed Black girls, women, non-binary survivors of violence. And it followed the airing of Surviving R. Kelly, which describes decades of emotional, physical, and sexual abuse he allegedly perpetrated against Black girls and women. And of course, in this instance, and many others like this, there is one big question. Why don't these women reach out to law enforcement for help? But I think the real issue is embedded into the racist, rape culture, and misogynic systems that pervade our society. And although we don't talk about it, and sometimes it's uncomfortable to talk about, it exists. And I think this pandemic has exposed it more than ever, which is also a good thing. But you see, Black women and girls have historically been dehumanized, considered unrapeable, and left without legal recourse, because that's just how our history has been from slavery days, right? So in a nutshell, I think many factors go into this that contributes to the fear of Black survivors reaching out to law enforcement. But I could think about three from the top of my head, just from my perspective as a Black woman. Like you guys mentioned at the beginning, the contentious history with law enforcement and the Black community, it leaves a lot of Black women reluctant to call the police, even when they should. The unfortunate truth is that Black women do not believe that the police are there to protect them. They see that their mom was abused, their aunt was abused, their aunt called the police, no report was made. They see things like this. It's like a cycle. And, it goes down with them that these people are not there to protect me, when they are. Two, for Black women, a strong sense of cultural affinity and loyalty to the community, like you mentioned before, it renders a lot of victims silent, where they're not always comfortable surrendering their own. Even like, I'm from the Caribbean, as you guys mentioned, and we don't have a lot of issues when it comes to race, but we have a lot of issues when it comes to loyalty and affinity to your community. Mm. People are raped by pastors all the time. Mm. And nothing happens of it, because why? He's the pastor. Don't pull him away from the community. He's a good person. He saves people. is this type of, oh, it translates into race. Like, that's my brother. That's my uncle. That's supposed to be my friend. We all know that in a lot of cases of rape and rape, especially, the victim knows who their rapists are. It's someone that knows them, you know? It could be their friend, someone that they thought was their friend or their uncle. A lot of the times that's the case. And then your family comes into it and they pressure you. Oh, this is a family issue. We could deal with this. We could handle this. Where in turn, they should really say, let's get, you know, law enforcement involved, because that's what they're there to do. And three, Black women also feel like they need to be strong, and asking for help is a sign of weakness. And I think in a sense, all of us are victims of this type of ideology. Like even me, like I typically try to extend myself to everyone. And when I need help, it's just so hard for me to say, hi, I need help. And quite frankly, we can't blame them. You know, we can't blame these victims for thinking that the idea of the strong Black women has forced many of us to feel like we have no one to go to because we're always supposed to be the superhero in the situation. We're always supposed to save ourselves. So thinking about these things and IPV, it has a lot to do with the culture, the way how, you know, we've been brought up. We've seen how IPV have been dealt with over the years, and just our own personal ideology, our own personal fears. I feel that contributes a lot to the way how we react or how we fear of reacting to law enforcement. I certainly feel like the pandemic has exposed a lot of the flaws with our systems, because I'm pretty sure before the pandemic, we felt like we were doing a really good job with IPV, right? Or at least we were having a handle on it. And then, you know, the pandemic came and it exposed how, oh my God, these communities don't really have the resources to get the help that they need. However, I do feel like our organizations that help survivors have been very innovative. I've read about a lot of like new initiatives that they've developed since the pandemic to make it easier for people to access them, like even having like silent chat rooms or making options where, you know, if a victim is on the website or something of that sort, they could easily exit. So I think that now more than ever, we're at a better place to help them. But I also think that we just can't sit down and be comfortable with it. We always need to be two steps ahead, because had it not been for the pandemic, clients would have to like walk into a building to get the help that they need, right? And it's like these situations have been happening ever since. Like people have been locked into their houses by their partners. They've been isolated with their abusers for years, and it's never been something that's hidden, you know? So continuing to find those innovative ways will certainly help. But as of now, I think everyone is just doing the best that they can to help these victims.
Thank you. And Ms. Torres, because Aldeama mentioned so much of it can be culture impacted or culture specific, I'm wondering, you know, what is your take on the fear that, you know, Latinx survivors of IPV have about reaching out to law enforcement? And do you think there's enough support and resources for that community as well to maintain safety if they do so?
Well, number one, yes, of course, the issue of the barrier of the language, it affects a lot. So the fact that we're trying to reach out and give them options in order to sustain those options right now during this pandemic is a little bit more difficult. We are able to, if they come to us, to try to get them into shelters and move them on. We have tried to move them from where they live and to a safer place. The pandemic has put limitations on access to just about everything. That's from filing orders of protections and seeking out shelters that at this point, since the pandemic started, has been very full, by the way. Culturally, Latino women do not call the police. It's a thing where the counterpart says, really, you're going to call the police on me? You're going to have me arrested, this, that, and the third. So that culture idea of not doing that and just sitting back and continuing to be abused and have all these things that come with IPV magnifies the fact that they don't reach out for help. With the new laws that came into effect at the beginning of the year, a lot of times you can have an abuser who is arrested and is released. It happens. It happens. So that in and of itself, prior to the pandemic, because everything just snowballed with the pandemic. Everything did. It's just having people reach out to try and get help. That this is one of the things that I've tried to do during this time, is to reach out not only to other agencies, but to let them know that we are here and we're able to do some of the things we can for the Latino woman that sometimes gets lost in the sauce when the language is a barrier. Mm-hmm. It's quite difficult. And not to say that the common denominator obviously is what it is, IPV, but there are instances with the Latino community that is a little bit different in terms of that not knowing, not having the ability to express what is going on, and sometimes using a child in the house to let the officers know exactly what happened, to take the statement. And things are lost in translation, obviously, for real. So them calling the police to try and say, this is a problem, a lot of times that I think that's one of the biggest barriers that we do have, unfortunately.
Yeah. Thank you.
So Dee, I want to actually go back to you and touch on something that, you know, you had started talking about in your last response. And, you know, I would love it if you wanted to expand on it a little bit more. You know, you've been in the Family Violence and Women's Rights Clinic at the law school for a couple of semesters now. And Lindsay and I, being in the COVID clinic as well, we all work very hard to be advocates for our clients. And you are working very hard to be an advocate for survivors. And Ms. Torres at Hispanics United is an advocate for survivors. But many survivors in communities of color still really have a deep-seated mistrust in the criminal justice system as a whole, not just law enforcement, but particularly law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So particularly when law enforcement officers, who are supposed to be one of the first lines of defense for survivors seeking help and assistance, have rates of IPV that are four times that of the national average and are able to continually and systematically get away with the constant murder of Black and Indigenous people of color in broad daylight. And so in your opinion, and Ms. Torres, feel free to speak on this as well. This isn't just a question for Dee. How can we as advocates, and you in your visible and powerful position as a woman of color as well in the legal profession, work to change the current system so that there is increased accountability for those who operate within our confines, but also work to change attitudes and opinions of that system that has really kind of left people of color so neglected and disaffected for so long?
In my experience so far, I've learned that there's no one way to change the current system. And it will take the teamwork of individuals on both a societal and governmental level to change all of the things that are blowing up right now. Systemic racism, patriarchal values, removing structural barriers, and implementing the laws that hold people accountable. But we can start by actively making sure that there are clear expectations and clear consequences. Don't bend the rule because the abuser is your brother, uncle, or your pastor, like I mentioned. Believe in victims and stand firmly with them in the fight for justice as they survive the most horrific experiences of their life. I think in the same breath, attitudes and opinions of the system that has neglected Black women and women of color and has left them disaffected for so long will only change when those exact systems start to work for them. So then again, it goes back to everyone in society working together to ensure that victims are protected and believed, and abusers are held accountable for their actions, no matter the race. I think this year and the pandemic has exposed how when people come together for a cause, things shift, right? So if we treat IPV as a problem that affects everyone, which it does, We can make a change together. It's not just going to be the government making the laws or the police going or responding to a call. It takes everyone. It takes the advocates on social media. It takes the social media influencers. It takes the person walking down the road and witnessing something. It takes everyone as a community, as one nation, to really come together and to fight this, because it's not just a one person problem or a one gender problem or a one race problem. It's a public health issue that everyone needs to put at least one effort into making that change.
Yeah, I think that we all know it's a very strong, strong rooted problem in this country. And personally, on this level, when I think about these problems that come through, and a lot of times I look at the whole thing and the entire domino effect that IVP has. And when we look at those things, we think about not only the situation of that victim in society and how society deems and looks at not only Latina folks or the brown skin folks also. That's rooted. I mean, it's something that it's been there. I get the idea of all of us trying together to try and make a change. And each one of us who does what we do, and we can think that we're making a change, but if you think about it in the whole scheme of things, we're just a grain of sand in this whole terrible situation that we are living. And then let's look about, you know, how the domino effect is on the children.
Right.
That's another thing, because that's our future. That's our future. And if we are not stepping up to the plate to show them that these things really matter in what should be and what shouldn't be. And if our leaders are not held accountable to say, you need to implement this, you need to put this law into place, this should be this way, they're just going to continue and look at this and say, no matter what I do, it's not going to make a difference. And that's what we have to pull back from. Yes, what you do is going to make a difference. And if everybody can say, I'm going to do this and it's going to make a difference, we will begin to see that change. But she is right in echoing and saying that once people get involved and there's a voice and there's a pushback, things will happen. But we all know that, you know, it's going to take a long time to make a change, a long time.
But what you're kind of speaking to is like empowerment on a societal level to encourage people to feel strong enough to persist, right? Even when they don't feel they're making an immediate
change. That's correct. That's correct. If you have these victims come through, and by the time they get to us, they have put their arms up in the air. They just can't go on anymore. And sometimes they just continue, but there's a little bit of them that says, I need to get out. I need to get out. I need to move forward. I need to do something. So giving them that opportunity to do that, it's harder now with this pandemic to give them the services that they need because there's such a limited access to everything, mm-hmm. but we try and we need to let them know. So I think that a lot of times what's happening now is they're sitting back and they're not making that call.
Right.
They're not making that call.
Right.
Well, it was noted in the introduction, Ms. Torres, that HUB, you know, Hispanics United of Buffalo, has the only bilingual domestic violence program in Erie County. In doing a little bit of research, as of July 2019, the Latinx community made up approximately 12% of the total population in Buffalo, New York. The total population in Buffalo, New York is, according to this document, 255,000 people. The almost 30,000 Hispanics living in the city, which comprises a large portion of the population. For that entire population, for only one space to remain available to survivors of IPV who cannot speak primarily English, who require bilingual or Spanish-speaking services, you know, that's quite a disparity. It seems as though there should be additional services or resources available. So I'm just curious, do you believe that the lack of available, you know, bilingual or Spanish-speaking IPV-related services in Erie County acts as a hurdle to Latinx survivors of IPV seeking help, even within not just in advocate systems or shelters, but even when dealing with the police, with those within the court system, whether it's family court, Supreme Court. Do you think that the lack of those resources presents a problem? Or do you believe that Erie County maybe addresses this, you know, better than I'm aware?
Well, the fact that HUB is the only agency in the city that does deal with Spanish-speaking clients, more is always better. So if we had that opportunity to branch out, yes, more is always better. That is probably why I make it a priority for me to reach out to other DV agencies and community agencies and let them know that we are here. Let it be noted, though, that a lot of the agencies throughout the city, the Be Safe program and City Court, the FJC, a lot of the other agencies and even the community agencies do have at least staff members who do speak Spanish. So a lot of times and more often than none, when that is the case, they do get referred to HUB for assistance. it's a small group that we have here. We're not a large group. Our core services are very unique in terms of what we offer our clients. We do walk the walk with them, as I like to say. But if the city had the resources to try and open up something else that would address the needs of the Hispanic community, that would be wonderful. It would be great. But unfortunately, that isn't happening right now. But so that is why I make it my point to reach out to the DV agencies and the community agencies to let them know that we are here. For lack of anything else, a lot of times people did not know that we were here.
And Aldeama, in your work with the Family Violence Clinic, do you work with a lot of minority communities and also perhaps immigrant communities? And, you know, do you believe that there may be a barrier, not just for the Spanish-speaking services, but just in terms of having someone who can speak the language of those individuals who are seeking help with the police, with the court systems, within advocacy systems in this area?
I think so, but I also think that's when cultural training comes into play, and it really helps because
yeah.
It's always going to be a more comfortable situation when you speak to someone that you know could understand what you're mm-hmm. saying or could understand mm-hmm. your accent or things of that sort. And as we could see, that's not always happening because there's just this gap between, you know, the people who are in the legal profession right now and the communities that we serve. So I do think that sometimes even beyond that, like just training or trying to be competent about, you know, what the type of phrases that they probably use or the type of tones or the type of, you know, demeanors that they have will always help. I feel like a client would be more open to someone where they don't feel like they're judged by. Mm-hmm. And I think that that too comes into play. Like a lot of times, like, they're fearful of being judged by the situation. Oh, why did you stay so long? Things of that sort, you know, just being aware of how you speak to someone can always make the difference no matter the gap. So I think just always trying to be like culturally aware about your client and the person that you're speaking to will help.
Thank you. That's actually a really great point. Cultural awareness, where it's not just about the language. It's respect for the culture as well.
Well, I mean, we've had a fabulous experience with both of you today. So we're actually at our last question. So really, this question is, again, for both of you. So we would love to hear both of your responses on this. But in what ways could we, you know, more generally as a society, make it more of a priority to protect and assist both Black and Latinx survivors of IPV? Particularly throughout the rest of the pandemic and beyond?
Well, looking at where we are now in this country and all around the world, I think one of the avenues that could help us would be the media. The media plays a large role in what goes on. And if the media could get out there and let them, you know, I mean, that's a force. That's a force. And if we use the media in that positive sense and letting people know that we are here to help them and letting them know there's always a place to call, that somebody can help you, reaching out. Like it was mentioned, there are Zoom meetings that are done with women who are survivors, and other women chime in. And if there's a problem, they kind of reach out to each other. Raising awareness is the key. Raising awareness that, listen, it's happening. You're not alone. There is help. We are here to help you. Of course, again, I reiterate that the pandemic has caused us to be limited in what we can and cannot do, but we will try our best to get these survivors out of their situations, get them safe, put them children in a safe environment. It's just, I also want to hit on something real quick, that what I've noticed since the pandemic, although the IPV is very prevalent, I'm finding that a lot of my clients are suffering from emotional and psychological abuse.
Yeah.
Sometimes there isn't even any physical abuse, and that is beginning to be a problem, because if we don't have the mothers of the children to be in a situation where they're stable, if they're not good for themselves, they're not good for their children. And I think that I've seen an increase of that, and that really, really bothers me. Because psychological and emotional abuse sometimes cuts deeper than that physical. So awareness, raising awareness is the key, letting people know that we are here. The media can play a big factor in that. And it has during the pandemic. If you notice your newscast, they were constantly putting down numbers across the ticker tape and letting people know that these are the places you can call and there's always help. Again, the pandemic has put limitations on probably putting people into shelter, getting them out of that immediate danger. But we're trying the best that we can. And again, media to me is a big awareness key in terms of trying to let people know that we are here and they could reach out to us.
For both of you, D, after you respond, feel free to add any contact info or numbers, websites, emails for both Hub and the clinic.
Okay.
After you respond to the question, D.
Definitely. So I completely agree with Ms. Torres. In many ways, the pandemic has helped to show us the way forward and what we need to do as a society, right? So, I mean, it has exposed many things. The way how the system never truly worked for minorities, for Black and Latin women of color who are surviving IPV. So I'd be short with just saying that in agreement with what Ms. Torres said. I also think that we can make protecting these individuals a priority by assessing the needs of their community and meeting them where they are in terms of providing resources and access to help. Because the sad story, like the truth of the matter is they need us, right? And it's just so hard for them sometimes to get to us. So that would go back to, you know, Ms. Torres speaks about the media, like putting that information out there for them. But us also trying to meet them where they are, because sometimes they don't have a TV in their house. Sometimes their abuser takes away their phone. And it's just sometimes like abuse is just always just a step ahead. You know, it feels like, wow, when will we ever catch up? But just by continuing to find, you know, innovative ways where they can access the help. Like we mentioned, the silent chat services. Sometimes abusers take them to go get grocery shopping, put up a sign, the number, if you need help, you know, things of that sort. But just continuing to find ways that they could access us or we could access them is key. And I think that that's just the way forward.
Thank you both so much. Do you have any contact information? I don't know if Hub has a hotline number or...
We do. We actually do have a hotline number. Hub does have a 24-hour hotline number. It is 716-481-8867. Again, that's 481-8867. And we're located right in the heart of the west side of the city on Virginia Street. But thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. I hope that this too shall pass and soon we can get back to some little bit of normalcy. And I appreciate the opportunity. Stay well, stay safe, stay healthy.
Fabulous. Yeah. So, well, I mean, this has just been such an amazing opportunity to have the both of you. And so having had the opportunity to have this conversation with each of you has just been wonderful. So thank you so much, Aldeama and Ms. Torres, for being willing to share your experiences and your wealth of knowledge with us, with the UB community, and so many others that will hopefully be tuning into this podcast. So for our listeners, we hope that you have enjoyed this episode of Bullshare with UB Law Responds, and that all of you listening today have thoroughly enjoyed this four-part series that has focused on the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on IPV within various relevant survivor communities. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening and being a part of Bullshare from UB Law Responds. If you'd like to learn more about the vital work our clinic students' attorneys are doing, providing pro bono access to justice for those who otherwise would not have legal and policy representation, head on over to www.ublawresponds.com. There you'll also be able to find other episodes of this podcast, but also a giving link to support our clinic students' work. We also have some great blogs from our clinic student attorneys and from other UB Law students who are working toward justice for all. On behalf of UB Law's clinical and experiential programs, thanks for listening. Stay safe, Stay strong and be your best you.